Tuesday night, I got home late from a work commitment, and as the Uber pulled up in front of my house, the Isha prayer, the last prayer of the day, sounded on the driver's phone. He quickly muted it. In response, I clasped my hands and said, Salam. He turned to me with the broadest, brightest, most radiant smile. In my attempt to bless him, I was blessed times over. May the words of my mouth this morning and the meditations of our hearts bring blessings times over. Amen. My late husband, Arthur, had a penchant for repeating stories. I figured he did it simply to annoy me, and that it did. But I'll be charitable this morning and say he did it because he loved a good story. He loved hearing a good story, even if he had to tell it. His most oft-repeated story came from college days at Haverford, near Philadelphia. He was in the members' lounge before a performance of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Maestro Ormandy arrived to receive tributes, and as he was leaving, Arthur, who was never short for words, appropriate or not, shouted out, "Good luck, Maestro." To which Maestro turned and, with arms flaying as if already conducting the orchestra, shouted back, "Luck! Luck has nothing to do with it. Either you can do it or you can't." A neighbor, John, died recently. John was in his late 70s, a Royal Canadian Air Force pilot, retired from the practice of law, the last few years the primary caregiver for his wife as her health declined. Despite the fact that John had become chief cook and bottle washer, he was no cook, or was he a bottle washer? M&M's was his idea of grocery shopping at that time. I dropped off a home-baked, not by me, pie one day. He was so grateful for something that hadn't come out of a package, he insisted on writing a check for me. I said, "John, don't be silly." He insisted. He wrote a check for $200 and told me to give it to my favorite charity. At his funeral, his son-in-law, Doug, described John's response to the doctor when he told him he could only reasonably expect to live another week or two. Doug said John took the doctor's hand, told him to sit down, and began, "Do you have a minute for me to tell you a story about good luck?" And he went on to describe a life of good lucks. He had been lucky, he said, from day one, being born into a poor family, because that meant that without toys, they learned to find joy and laughter in each other. He was lucky to be a young man during World War II, because it meant that after the war, he was able to go to university. The engineering courses he wanted to take at the University of Toronto were full up, and he had to settle for law. Later, having been hired as the lowest one on the totem pole at a large law firm, he lucked out again. He said it was a Friday of a long weekend. Everyone was away, and the partners came looking for someone to take care of a real estate deal before the weekend. He ended up heading up the real estate division. The good luck story goes on, including how he met his wife, the good character of their children and their grandchildren, and he concluded by looking at the doctor and saying, once again, his luck had come through for him. If he hadn't developed cancer, he would not have had the privilege of knowing such a fine, caring, and thoughtful doctor. Remarkable, eh? In the Old Testament, there is that character whose life is at least as full of luck as John's life. We met his father, Jacob, last week. His mother is Rachel. Joseph's luck also starts with his birth. Born into Rachel and Jacob at a time in their lives when fortunes were secure, he knew privilege that his older siblings, and there were 12 of them, had not known. With his privilege, he was lucky to have developed a strong attitude. But it was this strong attitude that incited his brothers and led them to plot against him. Rather than throwing him into a waterless pit in the desert and leaving him to die, they sell him to a passing caravan of traders. They took him to Egypt, where he was sold to the captain of the Pharaoh's guard. I've always felt a certain kinship with Joseph. I, too, am the youngest child, but only of five. My older four siblings were born over 6 years, and then there's eight before I come along. I'm told that they would have sold me to a passing caravan any opportunity. Later, when our mother's health was declining, there was one sibling we would have gladly paid a passing caravan to take to Egypt. Joseph's family is very complicated. Jason spoke of Jacob, Joseph's father, and his complicated relationships last week. And more of the story will be told in the coming weeks. But under the captain, Joseph prospers and becomes head of the household. True to his luck, the captain's wife notices him, notices his smooth skin, his lanky body, his broad shoulders. When he declines to respond to her advances, she accuses him of scandalous things, and he is thrown into prison. It's not my idea of luck, but it seems to be Joseph's luck. In jail, he meets the Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and the Pharaoh's chief baker. Both had also gotten on the Pharaoh's wrong side. The baker would be beheaded, not a good outcome. But the chief cupbearer returns to favor and returns to his service to the Pharaoh. Years later, the Pharaoh is troubled by dreams, and the cupbearer remembers this fellow that he was in prison with who used to be able to interpret dreams. He recommends him to the Pharaoh. If Joseph hadn't been lucky enough to still be in prison after all these years, he wouldn't have been brought into the Pharaoh's chambers, where he impresses the Pharaoh, wins his favor, and ends up in charge of all of the king's land. Head of the real estate division, eh? The Pharaoh gives him his signet ring, dresses him in the finest of linen robes, and puts a gold chain around his neck. He gets a chariot, a driver, an assistant, probably a corner office, and a tax-free salary. Now that is luck. But it doesn't end here. Years pass. It is Joseph's luck that a drought ravishes the entire land. Because of Joseph's careful stewardship of the product of the Pharaoh's land, however, the Pharaoh and his people have more than enough. People come from far and wide seeking help, including, guess who? Those miserable brothers. Maybe the lucky one here is not so much Joseph, but Joseph's father, Jacob. Because with his son in such a high place, instead of starving to death or dying of thirst, his family finds themselves brought to Egypt, settled in the best land in the country, provided with all the food and water they need, and placed in charge of the Pharaoh's livestock. Unlike my neighbor John, Joseph doesn't claim any of this as luck. He declares that it has all been part of the design and will of God. God had this all planned out for one purpose and one purpose only: to save Jacob's family, the descendants of Abraham and Sarah, from extinction by famine, and thus to save the Hebrew people, who are the first to see and know God as one. It's understandable, given the extraordinary tradition from which we come and how this tradition has been interpreted, that we should see God as the holy, omnipotent one in charge and in control of all that is. The Canadian Revenue Agency Charity Division calls this direction and control. They're really big on it. I'm with Joseph and not thinking that any of this is luck. But neither do I buy the idea that any of this has been the divine will exercising direction and control to cause X, Y, and Z to happen. When someone says in response to a tragedy like the death of a child or a horrible car accident or a natural calamity that it must be the will of God, I cringe. I can't imagine that this God of whom we speak, to whom we lift praises and call upon in prayer, the one whom Jesus points wills harm or hurt upon anyone or any part of creation for any reason. I think what we see in both my neighbors and in Joseph's stories, and what is made so profoundly and personally real in the stories of Jesus' life and his death, is that regardless of what we encounter in life or in death, there is nothing, nothing that can separate us from the one who created us in the beginning of time, the one who created all that is. In life, in death, in life beyond death, God is with us. We are not alone. We say that every Sunday. Instead of being the great controller, all-powerful and mighty and sitting upon a throne in the heavenly heights, think of God as an eternal will and a durable presence of love and compassion that generates and sustains life in even the most lifeless and life-denying circumstances, even from behind a gravestone. Trusting in this will, this presence, which is always longing for and leaning into life in all of its fullness and blessing, we find ourselves drawn out of those lifeless situations, those life-denying circumstances and times, and recreated for a new day when the possibility of good is restored and renewed. Good out of bad is not luck. Luck has nothing to do with it. Nor is it a divine plan that has been written out in the book since before time. It is the living, loving will of the Spirit of God which makes all good things possible, regardless of the anguish, evil, or darkness that we might pass through. If you are in that dark, evil place of anguish today, these words may be grit in your wound. Most of us in such times can't see beyond these times. I know I can't. It's at these times that a community of faith is so very important to us. Our role is to hold that faith, that trust, that confidence when others cannot. Michael Perry writes in the hymn, O God Beyond All Praising, whether our tomorrows be filled with good or ill, we'll triumph through our sorrows and rise to bless you still, to marvel at your beauty and glory in your ways, and make a joyful duty our sacrifice of praise. So be it. Amen.